Night gathers, and now my rewatch begins.
Welcome back to Oysters, Clams, and Cockles, the number one Game of Thrones podcast in the realm for people who party like Tyrion and slay like Daenerys, brought to you by Grand X Media. I am Ross Bolin, here in the Grand X Media studios in Austin, Texas, with Barrett Dudley.
What is up, my doggies?
You're back.
My clam fam. Yeah, I'm back. It, you know, whenever you miss a week, it feels like it's been...
an eternity.
Several, yeah.
Yeah.
Right away, just straight up apologize that you had to listen to Jared for a full hour last week.
People are upset. People are upset with you. It's on you. It's your fault.
Yeah. Yeah.
Real talk. Jared did a great job. Somebody had to step in.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, one man down. Next man up.
Exactly.
Next man up.
But we're glad to have you back. This is the Night's Rewatch. We're doing a podcast for every episode of Game of Thrones, starting with season one, episode one, leading up to the final season of our favorite show, so we can all be as prepared as possible. Take the black and join us. Tell your family members, your friends, your coworkers, your neighbors, anybody that you know that loves Game of Thrones. Tell them about Oysters, Clams, and Cockles, if we can all be better for it. As a member of the Clam Fam, as a brother or sister in the Night's Rewatch, you are capable of invoking Sumai on Man Outfitters at manoutfitters.com. When you do so, you will get 15% off your entire order if you spend $150 or more. Free shipping included always. We've got a bunch of new summer 18 stuff on manoutfitters.com right now. Fill up the cart. Spend at least $150. Type in S-U-M-A-I, that's Sumai, at checkout, and get that big 15% off discount.
A little birdie just told me that there have been some spring markdowns made today.
Oh my.
So stuff that is hot and fresh out the kitchen and is, I mean, in season, ready to wear right this second. It's not even the summer solstice yet. And we got swim trunks and Hawaiians and dope tees, you know, 25, 30% off already. And this is an instance where the elusive stacking will work.
So you can type in your code on top of
on
the
top,
markdown price.
Because this stuff's already on sale. So then your Sumai, when you invoke Sumai, you get a bonus, Jonas.
Wow.
Yeah.
Love that. Hitmanoutfitters.com today. Sumai at checkout. Our hotline number is 866-43-CLAMS. You can call anytime. It's a voicemail. Ask a question. Give us a theory, a take, whatever it may be. If you mess up, just hang up and call back. It's no big deal. We'll delete the one you messed up. We picked out a couple different calls this week from the hotline to play. The first one we're going to play right now. The second one we're going to play at the end of the episode. Here's the first one.
What's up, Clam Fam? This is Aaron from Northern Virginia. I'm calling with kind of some insider information, maybe. I just got back from Northern Ireland where I did a, you know, Game of Thrones filming locations tour. And we were supposed to go to the cave where Melisandre gave birth to her demon baby. But we were told we couldn't because HBO was currently filming in that spot. So I'm just wondering, like, what you guys think. They're filming there. Could it be, you know, another demon baby? Who would it be, John's, or could it be Gendry's again or whatever? So just let me know what you think. Also, a little bit of fangirl. As soon as we got off the bus for the tour, I ran into Cersei, aka Lena Headey, which was super dope. All right, thanks, guys.
Now I'm just imagining that Lena Headey hangs out at the bus stops for these tours just because she needs the attention. So, like, you know what I mean? It's like people are coming out the Game of Thrones tour bus and they're like, oh my God, it's Cersei. And
yeah,
she's
you
like,
can
oh
just
my God,
like,
I just happened to be here.
Yeah, you can just casually play it out like, oh my God, stop it. Don't even. Yeah, but really.
So sick of the attention.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but hey, it's nice to get some insider information that they're filming in that cave. Question, where was that cave? She gives birth, right, to the demon baby. It goes through the bars of the cave and up to wherever Renly is. But I can't remember where Renly was posted up at that point that this cave gives you access to.
Yeah.
I don't know. Somebody call and tell us.
For some reason, I want to say that that's near Dragonstone, but I can't remember where Renly was camped out. Was he outside of Dragonstone?
I don't know. I couldn't think of a good reason why anybody would need to get where that cave was. It just, that's interesting. That's all.
Yeah,
I'll say.
No, I can't. Nothing is coming to mind quickly to like where, why would we need to be back at that cave?
Right.
It could be somewhere in the Stormlands because Renly is Lord of Storm's End.
That's true.
Okay.
And Kat goes to meet with Renly wherever he is. So that could be a possibility. I don't remember.
Yeah.
I don't think they ever explicitly say in the show where
exactly he is. Mm-hmm. Right. I don't think so either. It's just interesting that they'd be filming there. It also could be that, like, you know, a homeless person wandered into the cave and took a shit, so they closed it down for the day. And rather than say that, they're like, oh, you can't go right now. It's super secret HBO filming, but I'm not trying to rain on your parade. Anyway, thank you for calling. Let's get into it. Season 4, Episode 10, the Season 4 finale, titled The Children, written by Benioff and Weiss, directed by Alex Graves. We start out right where we left off the last episode, with Jon Snow embarking on his long, lonely walk out the northern gate of the wall toward Mance Rayder and the wildling army that's in the forest. They're literally right there, because he gets right beyond the tree line and he's immediately tailed by wildlings to his left, his right. They're just kind of following him. It's a little weird that one of them doesn't just like hack his fucking head off. These are unhinged people, the wildlings.
Yeah, he's also, I mean, okay, I guess Mance is like pretty close outside of the wall.
Yeah.
But he seems like he's just right away just in wildling territory.
I mean, he literally, once you break the forest line, you're there.
Yeah, okay.
That's where they're at.
That's true. That's okay. Yeah. So they're right there. But you're right. You're right. Why do they even give him the benefit of the doubt? Why don't they just...
Yeah, it's a little strange. Just because you have a hard time believing... I mean, we see it in a little bit. You just have a hard time believing the wildlings would be disciplined enough to let him, just because he's walking with his hands up, to let him walk wherever he wants to walk.
I don't want to backtrack too much, and I have not gotten to listen to the last week's episode with you and Jared, but did y'all kind of... I did just want to throw my two cents on about episode 9. That was really, really like Jon Snow's like coming out party as a hero.
Right.
As like a superhero almost.
Sure.
Like,
and he steps up big time.
Yeah, and like rewatching that whole episode, I'm like, man, this is really the turning point where he is like probably our main protagonist.
Absolutely,
now. And he is just like kicking ass and taking names, and he's like, you know, first time in leadership, first time in command. It was just, that was something I wanted to note. So now he's just making decisions on his own.
It reminded me of Tyrion's scene at the Mudgate. Where he takes the initiative and leads the guys.
Right.
And it's like, that's his definitive moment where he really becomes a protagonist and a hero permanently. That's the same kind of thing for Jon Snow here. Like, everyone around him is blowing it, and he's like, fuck this, I'll do it myself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway, he gets straight to Mance's tent, who Mance immediately, very observantly, notes that Jon is wearing a black cloak again. And Mance tells Jon basically he's upset because he really trusted him. He believed him when he pledged himself to the wildlings and wishes he'd been loyal. And Jon tells Mance that he was loyal. He was loyal to his Night's Watch vows and to Corrin Halfhand, who ordered him to kill him to gain the wildlings' trust. So it's a little weird because Mance is like, hey, you lied to me. That's fucked up. And Jon's like, actually, on a technicality, I didn't lie to anyone. I am very true and honest, and I upheld my vows to both Mance or to Corrin Halfhand and to the Night's Watch. Sir, please do not question my. You know what I mean?
It's They. I mean, just Mance doesn't seem super upset.
Really,
like, in the grand
it.
Scheme of things,
he's kind
of
chilling.
He's pretty chill. And all, you know, all I kind of can note with that is just right away they both kind of immediately have that mutual respect for each
for
other
sure,
again.
Yeah. Well, Mance is chill even like when Stannis' army comes right. He's still just kind of like, eh, whatever. Let's do this.
Also,
it's just weird.
I just really thought that Gren came out of that tunnel. I completely did not realize.
Oh, no, nah, Gren's dead as fuck.
Yeah. So in the later seasons, the only dude we're rolling with is Ed.
Yeah. That's it. Everyone else is dead. In fact, John's just kind of like, hey, Ed, you're in charge now. Deuce. Good luck, bro. And Ed's I don't have any experience.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he does that in the last episode, but he does that later too, I guess.
He does it later, season seven, yeah. I don't have any leadership experience. That's Ed yelling.
Gotcha.
John walks away.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Mance is like, oh yeah, you kept up all those vows? Kept them all, huh? We're talking about sex here again, folks, because he knows about Egret. But one of the things, Barrett, we talked about when you were gone that was established in episode 9 by Sam is that fucking is not really breaking your vows.
That's true.
Technically, it's not.
It doesn't explicitly say it anywhere that you can't
bone.
Yeah.
And I'll say this, it's a little upsetting that it's being brought back up again when we literally just cleared it up last episode. So we don't appreciate that, Mance. Mind your fucking business. John and Mance are very straightforward with each other. As Barrett pointed out, there's a lot of mutual respect here. John tells Mance that Egret is dead, that it wasn't his doing. Mance is like, well, let's drink to her. At first, John is like, I'm not drinking this. You could have poisoned it. Mance is like, of all the ways I'd kill you, poison would be the last. Because you have to remember, poison is largely considered to be a woman's weapon or like a coward's weapon in Westeros. John ends up drinking some of the drink. He coughs. He's like, it's not wine. And Mance is like, no, it's a proper northern drink, Jon Snow. I guess this is like wildling moonshine.
Yeah, yeah. Just toilet wine.
Hardcore booze that only the wildling stomach can handle. Jon Snow, not so much. We do find out here which giant went down in the tunnel. Mance says, you did well, fought hard, killed some of our strongest men. One of our giants went into your tunnel and never came out again. Mag the Mighty. He was their king, the last of a bloodline that stretches back before the first men. Question, why send Mag the Mighty then, man? How about maybe like one's still chilling in the forest somewhere? He's not the king. Shouldn't someone that's not the giant king be out there risking their ass?
You know, good kings, good leaders, they fight with their men. They get out there.
Well, RIP Mag the Mighty.
Yeah.
I really just need to know where 1-1 was at.
Gren came from a farm.
Was he? I loved that. I loved that exchange. They drink to Mag. They drink to Gren.
To Gren and Mag.
Yeah.
To Mag and Gren.
Yeah. Who came from a farm. Mance tells John that he sent 400 men to climb the wall at an unmanned stretch 5 miles west of where they're meeting right now. He's very upset. Like he says, my people have bled enough. That they're not here to conquer. They're just here to hide behind their wall. They just need to pass through the tunnel. He says, now we both know winter is coming, and if my people aren't south of the wall when it comes in earnest, we'll all end up worse than dead. You want to strike a bargain with me? Here's a bargain. You go back, you open the gates to us, and I swear to you that no one else will die. Refuse, and we'll kill every last man at Castle Black. So this isn't even about conquering.
No.
It's not about rolling south and taking out all the normal people, all the normies who aren't wildlings, and taking over the castles and shit. They just want to get south so that they, too, can use the protection of the wall against the White Walkers and the Whites. That's it. Seems like a pretty simple request. Frankly, this all could have been done a lot easier, it seems like. But yeah, whatever.
Who knows?
There's a moment here where John flinches, and all of the other men in the tent with John and Mance draw their weapons, and Mance realizes why John is really there. Because I had forgotten at this point. They've been doing so much small talk. I forgot that John's whole point was to go kill Mance.
He wanted
later
to try to kill Mance, yeah.
Yeah, it seems like he kind of... I don't know. Mance immediately questions whether John would have the stones to kill a man in his own tent after he's offered him peace. And before this whole thing can kind of get resolved, a horn blows, which is never good. Mance puts a knife to John's neck and says, are you attacking us? John says, no, it's like you said, we don't have the men. And then we see hundreds of men on horseback in formation, like very organized military attack here.
Entering the woods. They're flanking them.
Oh, flanking hard. And they've got Stannis banners going.
All right, how the hell did Stannis get there? He went through the wall? All the men came through the wall in like the 10 minutes that Jon Snow's been gone?
I don't know.
How they get north of the wall?
Because they are north of the wall. You're right. It must be wherever they landed from by ship.
Okay.
Because they're coming from Dragonstone, right?
They went up to the one, the sea, the something or other up
East
there.
Watch by the
East
Sea.
East Watch by the Sea.
Possibly. It's hard to say, but there's a definite... lack of explanation there. I don't know. We don't need... The point is they came by ship, right, Luke? That's the general idea?
Right. They probably landed beyond the wall or something. And you say Dragonstone, but remember Essos too. They came from Braavos with all the cell swords and things like that. So right. They probably came with their army from there, landed beyond the wall.
It's just interesting that we never really think about Stannis as having been north of the wall with a large force, but he has. At this point, he is, you know? Comes through... wrecking shit north of the wall. We watch people get fucked up for a few minutes here, and eventually Mance is like, oh, this is ridiculous. Stand down. I said my people have bled enough, and I meant it. I'm not sure why you waited. Like, they were getting totally wrecked. Horses just riding through people. Reminded me of that, like, opening scene of Gladiator, the opening fight, the first battle, with the Romanians, I believe. And as a side note, Mance upset, keeps saying my people have bled enough. They really didn't bleed all that much. You know what I'm saying? They got 100,000 people here. 100,000 people up against 100 people at the wall. Yeah, they probably took, I don't know, 60 people died or some shit in that battle last episode. Seriously. And he's like, oh God, I don't know if we can spare anymore. My people have bled enough. Dude, you have 100,000 people. Did you expect this to be a casualty-free affair?
He cares about each and every one of them. You know, that's 60 dudes. That's a lot of blood.
It's just weird to me. It should be like you're willing to sacrifice it all to save as many as you can. I don't know. Whatever. I guess I'm not Mance and he's not me. If he was me and I was him, he'd use my body to get to the top. Ace Ventura. Stannis and Davos. Stannis.
Smoking.
The mask. Stannis and Davos ride up, and some moron wildling who, this is what I was referring to earlier. Mance is like, stand down, enough of us have died. Stannis and Davos ride up, and then some lunatic wildling is like, ah, I'm gonna kill him, and makes one last ditch effort to kill Stannis and immediately gets ridden down.
It's a pretty valiant effort. He really just tried to steal home there, and you gotta respect him for it.
It's hilarious for some reason. It's very funny to watch him get ridden down by a horse that just like, it comes into the frame, murders this dude, and exits the frame in one fell swoop. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's just funny. But that's why I'm asking, like, wait, so there was no, you know, off the hinges wildling to kill Jon as he was walking through the forest with his hands up.
Right, right,
yeah. But then there was one after Mance, literally 5 feet from here, just said,
Good point.
Stand down.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Just, I'm here to poke holes and ask questions. That's what I'm doing. Mance refuses to kneel to Stannis. Stannis reminds him that by nightfall, he'll have thousands of his men in chains and that their fate depends entirely on what Mance decides to do, the king beyond the wall. Mance says, all the same, we do not kneel. This is very important. They're not kneelers.
That's their cornerstone, some might say.
No kneeling. No fucking kneeling.
No kneeling.
They don't take communion. They don't kneel. Stannis orders all these men to be put in chains, orders Mance to be put into chains. Davos is like, hey, what the fuck is a dude with a Night's Watch cloak doing here with this squad? And Jon explains that he was sent to negotiate terms. Davos gets upset because Jon doesn't address Stannis as your grace, as you're supposed to address the one true king in Davos' opinion. And Jon is like, I know he's the king. I know who he is. My father died for him. I'm Ned Stark's son. So just to get a little history here, a reminder, I guess. John references that his father died for him. Does he mean in the way that Ned wanted Stannis to be on the throne?
Yeah. Like he was sticking his neck out.
And it caused him to die.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because to say that he died for Stannis is a little inaccurate.
He died because
he was backing Stannis. He wanted to.
Right. Yeah. Because instead of just shutting his mouth and agreeing to the whole fraud king that's going on up there, he was like, nope, it's Stannis. This whole Tom and Joffrey thing is a bunch of BS.
He also could have gone with Renly.
Yeah.
But he was like, nah, that's not right. There's an older one out there somewhere. We got to get the older one. Ned.
That old dumbass.
Follow the rules, Ned, is what they call me. Honest Ned.
Yep.
Uncle of Abe. Where are we? What are we talking about here?
We are talking about Stannis being up in the north and taking Mance away.
Oh yeah, what a bummer. Anyway, John tells Stannis he needs to burn all the bodies before nightfall, all of them, and then we jump over to King's Landing, where this is a scene. It is very rare in Game of Thrones that I watch a scene where I'm like, oh man, I do not remember seeing that. In fact, I don't know that it's ever happened before, and it happened to me here. Qyburn has the mountain on a table, mm-hmm. and he's working on him in front of Pycelle and Cersei. This was completely wiped from my fucking memory. I don't remember this at all.
Yeah, I do remember this. This happens to me with great regularity, but this was not one of those times.
It never happens to me. And yeah. It happened here, and I was excited about that because it felt like the first time. The mountain has all these like gnarly boils and rot. He's like decaying anywhere that Oberyn's weapon touched him. And Cersei is like bloody Martells. She's very aware of this whole... he used poison.
Aye.
And Pycelle points out that this is all because of what is called manticore venom, which sounds tight.
Mm.
And Qyburn says it is. The death's head manticore, which sounds like a particularly bad strain of manticore, whatever that is.
Yeah, it's the most deadly one.
Yeah, very knowledgeable about this, Qyburn is. Pycelle is like, hey, there's nothing to be done. The Sir Gregor is well beyond saving, especially for a man who's not even a maester and much less a grandmaester. And Qyburn is like, bitch, I got this. And Pycelle is like, that's exactly the sort of arrogance that got him expelled from the Citadel, your grace. And Cersei's like, Pycelle, get your fucking old ass out of here.
Yeah, you're done, son.
It's his own laboratory.
Not anymore.
He gets booted.
Yeah.
And it literally isn't anymore. I think this is the last moment that it was his.
Yes.
And from here on out, it's Pycelle's.
Now, okay, here's my kind of question for you. And I think Cersei kind of answers it in this scene, but it feels a little strange to me that they are willing to go to such great lengths to save this guy. Like,
right.
Anybody else, he's just another soldier, warrior, bodyguard, whatever.
I guess because he's so special.
Good. He's so incredibly
big and
brutal
strong.
And big and strong and just a killing machine that Cersei at this point feels like they need him around.
Right. I think it's a combination of his size, his skill level, his unwavering loyalty to the Lannisters.
Yeah.
I guess you could put it this way. He will literally do anything you pay him to do. And she's like, what could it hurt? Yeah, sure. Let's see if we can get this guy save his, or what else is Qyburn going to be doing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
This is like a really interesting look into how he kind of resurrects the mountain or keeps him alive, I guess. The mountain's not dead at this point, right? We don't know if he ever fully dies.
I don't think he dies.
I can't remember if we get any more scenes of him before he becomes the mountain as we now know him in season 7 and 8 or whatever. But
not much.
He's
if we
getting
do.
Pumped full of like, or I guess what we see is Qyburn taking blood out, like taking poison blood out of his body.
Mm-hmm.
And he is presumably going to replace it with something else.
Right.
Just, we get a little look at the science behind all this bullshit. And Qyburn mentions that he believes he can do this based on his experiences he's done this type of thing before. He's fucked around with it a lot. You know what I mean? It's almost like he's made attempts at Frankenstein before,
mm-hmm.
and this time it actually finally fully works.
He's figured it out.
Because he does
by
mention,
God.
Yeah, he's like, the process may change him somewhat. And Cersei's like, will it weaken him? And Qyburn says, oh no. Cersei's like, oh, that's good then, because that's all she cares about, is literally how strong he is. So that's when he starts draining blood from him. Cersei then goes on to meet with her father, Tywin. And to further complain about the situation, the whole arranged marriage thing, she's like, I will not marry Loras. Tywin is like, yes, you will. She's like, no, I won't. Tywin is like, do you think you'll be the first person dragged into a sept and married against your will? And then Cersei finally explains, like once and for all, to Tywin why exactly she is so opposed to marrying Loras and moving to Highgarden. She already lost one boy, right? Joffrey. He's gone. He's dead. She lost a daughter. Marcella was shipped off to Dorne. She says there's no fucking way she's leaving Margaery and Tywin to fight over Tommen until they rip him apart, basically. So her remaining son, Tommen, who is now mm-hmm. king,
yeah.
she sees exactly how this is going to play out if she's taken out of the picture. She believes that Tywin and Margaery, she says something along the lines of Margaery will dig her claws into him, you'll fight for your half, and you'll rip him apart, which is probably very accurate.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting line because, yes... Marjorie and Tywin are both going to try to play Tommen to the best of their ability to
their benefit. To get what they want out of it. They've begun the process almost.
But I also thought it was a bit of the pot calling the kettle black because Cersei ends up kind of doing this anyway. She gets her claws in him. And because of her, you know, machinations and game playing.
Yeah.
And unwillingness to let the Tyrells be, basically. She kills him.
Yes. And I think that there's, to that point, she snaps a little more between now and then, right? Like, her dad gets murdered at the end of this episode.
Mm-hmm.
Everything kind of crumbles further. I think she's so consumed by hate for Tyrion that it causes her to lose focus even further. Like, yes, I agree with you. She is 100% responsible for the death of Tommen, because she completely lost sight of what she was, what being a mother was all about in the first place. And that's kind of, I think she hasn't lost that quite yet at this point. Then we have a huge moment between Cersei and Tywin. Cersei threatens to tell everyone the truth, and Tywin is like, "What truth would that be?" Things get very, very real. Cersei says, "One look in the past 20 years, one real look at your own children, and you would have known." And Tywin still plays dumb. He says, "Known what?" She says, "Everything they say is true about Jaime and me. Your legacy is a lie." And Tywin's in full-on denial mode. He says, no, I don't believe you. And she says, "Yes, you do." This is a huge moment, and it's one that I probably have never, as a viewer, as a Game of Thrones fan, I don't think I've ever given like proper weight to this moment, honestly, because it's over basically between Cersei and Tywin right here. Like, her telling him all this, confirming to him everything that maybe he has refused to believe over the years about her and her brother and their incestual relationship, which has given them illegitimate children. She's basically telling him, "Hey, the king, not the king. He is not legitimate. And I will tell everybody that unless you fucking cancel this bullshit marriage that I don't want." It's a big, big, big moment.
I mean, that's her trump card.
And it's because
you're
kind
of wondering what she's going to play here to get out of this.
Right, because we've never seen anybody play a trump card that could properly put down a Tywin movement.
Right.
It happens here. He has no play after this. I mean, he has to agree with her. He has to agree to give her what she wants, because otherwise she will literally ruin his entire fucking legacy.
Yeah.
His, everything about him. And that's all he seems to care about.
Well, right? I liked her line a lot, and just, you know, I thought it was just cool in general. When she was like, "You're so consumed by the idea of your family that you're not even like really paying attention to your actual family."
It was a very good explanation of Tywin as a character.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
it was cool.
Yeah, the idea of his legacy, of his family, which he perceives as legacy, is so much more important to him than what is actually happening.
That he's literally lost sight to
the members of his family.
Yeah, yeah. It's fucked up. It's sad. Cersei immediately leaves and visits Jaime, who, for whatever reason, I laughed out loud when she enters this room and Jaime is in there. He's just staring at his weak ass page in that Kingsguard book that he needs to fill up that has been referenced multiple times in this season.
Yeah, it has.
The concept of him hanging out in that room, just staring at the book, staring at his page and being like, "What can I do to fill up this book?" is so fucking funny to me. I don't know why, but Jaime's obviously upset that his little brother Tyrion has been, you know, convicted, sentenced to death as a result of the trial by combat. Cersei again brings up how he killed their mother. Again, how Tyrion killed their mother. And Jaime, finally, somebody fucking asks, "Are you really mad enough to blame him for that? He didn't decide to kill her. He was an infant." Yes, this is a very good point that probably should have been reiterated roughly a million times to Cersei between the ages of like 3 and where we're at now.
Yeah.
He didn't choose to do that. I can't believe this is the first time we're seeing somebody actually make that argument. Anyway, Cersei kisses Jaime. She says, "I choose you." She tells Jamie that she told Tywin everything about them, that she won't marry Loras, that she's staying right there with Tommen. At one point she says, I don't want to talk about Tywin Lannister. I don't choose Tywin Lannister. I don't love Tywin Lannister. I love my brother. I love my lover. People will whisper and make their jokes. Let them. They're all so small, I can't even see them. I only see what matters. She kisses Jamie's gold hand, and then they bone on the Kingsguard table thing where the book is kept.
Yeah, and he's super into it. And I mean, just,
it's hot.
Just like any girl, as soon as she just gets that confirmation that her dad is just totally against it, hates it, now she's just right back into it. Now she's totally down again.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Worst thing Tywin could have done is not approve of his two kids boning. Threw her right back into his lap. And, you know, we know Jamie horny. Jamie been horny yes. since he got back.
Yeah.
He's been having a really hard time getting Cersei to love him again.
Oh, yeah.
And he seemingly gets what he wants here, which is, it's kind of sad to see him break back the other direction. But again, you have to keep in mind the feelings he has for her and how all messed up all their relationship is. Anyway, from there we bounce over to Meereen, where Dany is hanging out on her throne and letting people come in and complain about shit and visit and ask for things or whatever kings and queens do on those thrones when they have anybody can come in and visit. You have like a scheduled appointment. You wait in line or whatever. And some dude named Finnez, F-E-N-N-E-S-Z, Finnez, he comes in and he's older. He's an older gentleman. He's complaining about the fact that before she freed him, he was a tutor for some rich guy's kids, right? And that he had this great relationship with these kids. But that when Dany came in and took over, he had to leave his master's house. He no longer gets to teach those kids. And now he's just a homeless old man. Danny's like, hey, listen.
Hate to see it.
Yeah, old man, I get that you think you're displaced, but we built barracks and mess halls all over for the former slaves. And Finnez is like, yeah, but when you go to those mess halls or those barracks, the young people just beat the shit out of you. they just beat your ass and take your food.
And take you for your shit.
So it's not great.
Not what you want, no.
And he requests that he be allowed to sell himself back to his old master. And says that there are many, many other people waiting in line, begging to do the same. Waiting to beg to do the same. That the old like him... These people that have lived the same way of life forever, they're too old to change. And this is an issue that it's addressed in many ways throughout history. One of the ones that pops to mind for me is the dude in Shawshank Redemption. When he gets released, he gets paroled, and then he can't handle regular life. He even attempts to not get paroled by committing another crime while in prison.
Yep.
And then when he gets out finally... He can't do it. He can't handle it. So he ends up killing himself. What is that dude's name? That's going to drive me nuts. Brooks.
Well, yeah. And the things that you kind of can draw parallels to here are the one you mentioned, which is like prison, and then also military.
Yep. A lot of people get out of the military, can't readapt to normal society, either make a lifelong military career out of it or... find themselves having a really, really hard time attempting to readjust.
Yeah. So but things are not going great.
Not going great. And I think it's pretty cool that they took the time to address the fallout from stuff like this. Right.
Right.
Because it wouldn't be just a perfect world.
No, of course not. You can't just come in and change an entire society
without some fallout.
Wholesale and then expect it to just go smoothly and perfectly after that.
Yeah. So Dany does see that, and she says that she will allow this old timer, and I'm assuming many others who have the same issue, to sign a contract with his former master, but that it may not cover a period lasting longer than a year. Which sounds great on paper, right? No pun intended.
Yeah,
it does.
Yeah.
It sounds like a good solution, but Barristan Selmy immediately points out, like, hey, look, the masters are going to take full advantage of this. They'll be slaves in all but name, which is a problem. But we don't address that anymore because the next guy approaches, some poor dude speaking low Valyrian, who says, he's speaking broken low Valyrian. It's like, I have brought you, he came from the sky, the black one, the winged shadow, he came from the sky, and my girl, my little girl, he's carrying the bones of his deceased daughter who got fried by Drogon.
Yeah. Drogon, no.
Yeah, super weak sitch.
So, the first time that we get a guy bring a bag of bones to
it's like lambs,
Daenerys,
or goats,
yeah,
goats, whatever.
I was like, oh man, is this going to be the kid, right?
Right. I thought that was this. Yeah.
And then it's the goat. And so I was like, oh no, it's totally chill.
Maybe they
Drogon yeah. only kills a goat. And then this guy comes in with the bag of the bones, and I'm like, oh no, he gets both of them.
Exact same thing happened to me when the first
he does the kid too.
Literally the exact same thing. After we found out the first guy was goats, I was like, oh, maybe that never happened with a kid. Maybe I just played that up in my mind.
Yeah.
Nope. So it turns out there is downside to freeing a slave city. There is also downside to owning a enormous black dragon that breathes fire.
Indeed. Indeed.
Because on occasion, he'll flame a little girl.
Mm-hmm.
That's a problem. And Dany meets with Missandei and Grey Worm to discuss the problem. They haven't seen Drogon in some time. Apparently some sailors saw him flying over the Black Cliffs 3 days ago, but nothing since then. And Dany decides what she has to do. She says, meet me at the catacombs to Missandei and Grey Worm. She takes Rhaegal and Viserion, the two dragons that she does know where they are, the smaller ones. Drogon is the black one who's flying off freely, frying little children. Rhaegal and Viserion are right there. Puts him in the catacombs, chains him up, because she doesn't know what else to do. And it looks like there's some like water and shit in there. There's some food. But she's clearly not happy about having to do this, but she knows she has to. She doesn't have another play. She doesn't know what to do. Right?
Right. And I'll just say, these dragons, they don't seem happy about this.
they go fucking berserk. When they realize, like, hold up. She's leaving us. It's like the little girl in Jurassic Park when the lawyer leaves and goes and sits in the toilet and eventually gets eaten. Mm-hmm. He left us.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
They're freaking out. They're not down with this. And you have to remember, captivity is what killed off the Targaryen dragons generations ago. Because this keeps them from growing. Like, when they're in captivity like this, it stunts their growth, their development. Which is why we've had it explained how there were all these dragon skulls that they used to keep in the hall, right? In the Red Keep. There were huge, huge, huge ones, like of Balerion the Dread or whatever. And then there were these little bitty ones that were like the size of dog or cat skulls because they fucked up all the dragons by keeping them in captivity.
Yeah.
So this is not good.
And he's not mentioned by name, but you got to think, this entire episode, just kind of the pall of Jorah is hanging over them. Because...
yeah.
He's not there to help. And yes, she's got Barristan there, but she doesn't know Barristan as well.
Barristan's mostly a military guy, right?
Yeah, and he's mostly like tactical, you know, that's military.
Because she doesn't even, if you notice, when she meets with the people to discuss the issue of the dragon frying children, it's Missandei and Grey Worm. Barristan's not even there, right? So
he's there behind him.
Oh,
behind
he is?
Her. Remember, he offers the advice about the slave contract.
I think that's before, though. In the throne room, Barristan's there. But then she's like, meet me elsewhere to discuss this problem.
Post, yes.
After the old man, younger guy tells him about his daughter. Whatever. Anyway, point being, I think Barristan is more of a military advisor. Jorah was like an all-around confidant.
Right. Yep.
Could be trusted with any situation.
Yes.
And you're exactly right. It's a good point. I hadn't really thought of that. He's not there to help her. She doesn't know what the fuck to do. She's kind of lost here. They're going psycho as she leaves. She's like weeping as they roll the stone in front of the door to keep the dragons locked in. It's a fucked up situation. It's not good. Back at the wall, Maester Aemon is presiding over a funeral for everyone who died in the wildling assault on the wall during episode 9. And now their watch is ended. It ends is Aemon's address, and then they're all put to flame by Jon Snow. And we get this close-up of dead Grin's face as Jon Snow puts the torch to this massive funeral pyre that they've built. In the background, you can see Stannis, his psycho wife, and Shireen and Davos are all watching as these bodies burn. Which is a little... the transition was a little funky. It's like Stannis rides in north of the wall, tramples a fuckload of wildlings. Mance Rayder surrenders immediately. Like, basically puts up zero fight. And next scene we get, they're all inside Castle Black. There's just not really like a... I needed like a Stannis arriving to Castle Black or something. You know what I mean? To kind of like...
yeah, yeah.
There's no transition, and it's just... I guess that's to kind of give you the feel for how discombobulated everything gets here when it's like, who's in charge? Are we now answering to a king? Where the fuck is Alistair Thorne, the acting knight commander? I mean, whatever. What do you call him? Lord Commander of the Night's Watch. Thank you, Intern Luke. It yeah. just is a mess at the wall.
Yeah. And I mean, it's. Well, they got ambushed by Stannis. They had no idea to expect that.
Yeah, this is a.
You want to be like, oh, well, why didn't, you know, they outnumber these dudes like 1,000 to 1. Like, what are they doing? Like, they no fight at all. But I mean, Stannis has a pretty large army, like all we already talked about, all on horseback. They're really well trained. They're in an actual military position. Right. And man,
he has no choice. You're right.
Yeah. There's not a lot he can do. If he does anything, he's just basically.
It's just poor planning.
Committing suicide.
They went through all that shit, built the biggest fire the North has ever seen. That's a quarter of a mile long in the forest. And then they assault the wall. And they never accounted for at any point the fact that they could be attacked from some other angle. It's just bad. All around, big ass waste of time. Whatever, we'll move on. John visits Tormund in his cell. He's still locked up at Castle Black. And Tormund is like really confused about why an old blind man patched him up. He's presumably talking about Maester Aemon. But it's unintentionally humorous, or maybe intentionally. He's all psyched about being a prisoner. And it reminds me a little bit of Mr. Garrison in South Park. When any scene where he's being tortured or like anything bad is happening to him, he derives pleasure from it.
Uh-huh.
Tormund is like, he asks, you want me alive so you can torture me? So how do we die? Hanging? Beheading? Drop us from the top of the wall? And I just now am remembering, it's not Mr. Garrison, it's Mel Gibson. It's how they portray Mel Gibson. Yes. He's do you want to do? Torture me? Clamp my nipples? And that's what fucking Tormund reminded me of here. Like, how do we die? Hanging? Beheading? Drop us from the top of the wall? Tormund... It's very funny. Anyway, he tells Jon Snow, you spent too much time with us, Jon Snow. You can never be a kneeler again. Jon asks Tormund if he wants to say a few words over the wildling bodies that they burn. And Tormund is like, words? The dead can't hear us. Apparently that's not something the wildlings care about, funeral procession-wise. As Jon turns to leave the room, Tormund asks him, did you love her? He says, she loved you. And all she ever talked about was killing you. That's how I know. And he makes a point to say she belongs in the North, the real North. You understand me? And John does fully understand. He rides to the northern front of the wall with Ygritte's body. He builds a funeral pyre just for her on the north side of the wall. And he burns her there. And it's very emotional. He's clearly fucking broken from this whole situation. The loss of Ygritte. Everything that has transpired. It's kind of drained Jon Snow, right?
Yeah.
He just looks like, fuck me. Like,
he's totally over it.
He needs a win in the worst fucking way. Mm-hmm. He's like crying. And we don't see him break often, if ever. Emotionally, he's a pretty even keel guy, right? No matter what's going on, he tries to say, he stays in like a very solemn, brooding, yet slightly positive
Sure. Yeah.
That's kind of the way he is. Here we literally see him like start to cry.
Yeah.
And then the K like cuts away from him quickly. But it's just a weird reminder that like we've discussed it before. Ygritte will always be Jon's like first love, right? Will always feel like his true love. Khal Drogo will always feel like Dany's. And then they find each other later on.
Yeah.
And it'll just be interesting to see if they can build that love in a way that makes it supersede the other two relationships that they had.
Yeah, yeah. I did note, you know, don't feel too bad for this guy because he gets Ygritte IRL and he gets Dany later.
That's very true.
He gets the best of both worlds.
That's very true. Good positive lens to look through it at. North of the wall, Hodor is dragging Bran while Jojen and Mira Reed walk closely behind. Jojen is weak as fuck. He's been looking terrible for weeks. He's been looking terrible for multiple episodes. He can barely walk. He falls down at one point. Mira realizes we're not going to make it. And then Jojen's like, actually, we're already here. And you're like, oh my God, it's so crazy. He fell right when they happened to get there. Then Bran sees it. It's this weirwood with a face and red leaves. It's surrounded by like big boulders. It's the one we've seen in his visions. It is truly lit. Literally, there's like a light emanating from it. It's like a biblical scene.
Yeah, yeah.
It's funky. It's like the tree of life or the tree of knowledge, whatever it is. It's in the Garden of Eden. And you're like, hey, we made it. We fucking did it. We made it. We've got this journey is over. Bran has made it to the tree where hopefully the three-eyed raven is inside. And as they walk closer, skeleton arm pops up out of the ground, grabs Jojen, and you're like, what the fuck? And then all of a sudden there's skeletons popping out all over the place. What the hell is this? One grabs Hodor. Others are fighting Mira and Jojen. One gets to Bran, and it like just so happens to ironically be a legless skeleton who has to crawl on top of him. Anyway, Summer shreds that thing before it has a chance. Are these whites? Like, are they under control of the White Walkers?
I remember this scene was one of the first Game of Thrones scenes that I recall kind of provoking some irksome takes on the interwebs.
Yeah.
People didn't like love this. It just got like way too like Pirates of the Caribbean and magical and dead skellies chomping on you.
Oh, yeah.
At one time.
That's a good way of putting it. It was the Pirates of the Caribbean feel of the skeletons.
Yeah.
Mixed with the magic fireball throwing of the little girl.
Yeah.
In one
and it's just like
bullshit scene that's never explained.
My other issue with it on this rewatch is like we got, you know, freaking children of the forest, these crazy, super powerful, supernatural beings who
right.
like invented the world. We get the three-eyed raven in there who knows everything to a T.
Yep.
And he can't foresee that they're going to encounter a little trouble with these gnarly skeleton dudes. Like, why hadn't the little girl out there throwing her fireballs earlier?
I don't know, man.
You know, like they just, I don't know. It just seemed kind of...
Yeah, it's a little forced. And it just...
We've been calling for you to come to the tree, you know, even three-eyed ravens, even like, even though you're a little late or something like that. He doesn't say that. He says it's at a late hour or something like that.
Yeah, the hour is late.
The hour is late.
Which he just stole that line straight from Gandalf, but whatever.
But, okay, well, then help these dudes out. I'm sure you know that there's this field full of
you
skeleton
should know,
mines.
Right? You should know. I spent a lot of time thinking about the skeletons because this is ridiculous. And... Every situation, you have to assume that these are under control of a White Walker.
I don't know what they are.
You have to assume that.
Yeah, I guess they're whites.
And that maybe they were buried outside this tree
mm-hmm.
just in case the next person, or you know, whatever, somebody came through and then they could be brought up. I don't know. It sucked. At one point, Hodor is getting tag teamed by these things and then Bran wargs into him. And works over these two skeletons. It turns out Bran is a much better Hodor than Hodor actually is. He just kicks ass as Hodor. At one point, and they literally show you this, Mira pushes her brother Jojen to the ground yeah. to keep him from trying to fight. And then, as a result, he's stabbed six times in the stomach. She's like, get the fuck down, Jojen. You shouldn't even be trying to fight. Pushes him down next to a white that kills him.
Yeah, yeah.
It's entirely her fault. What the fuck was that? Anyway, Hodor sees Bran about to get attacked by two more skeletons. You're like, holy shit, this is really bad. This could be it. It could be all over. And then boom, suddenly both skeletons explode in a ball of fire. And that little Children of the Forest girl says, come with me, Brandon Stark. And she's actually a child. All the other Children of the Forest we've seen are like in their 40s looking physically.
Well, that's
facially.
That's because they recast her. This is the only Child of the Forest we see.
So far. I guess the ones we see later don't yes. look so much like children is what I'm saying.
Well, that's because they recast the Three-Eyed Raven, too. I don't know what the hell
yeah,
they were
the
doing.
Yeah, the Three-Eyed Raven, this initial one, is very strange.
And we've talked before on the potty about, and I think we've made references to, like, we keep thinking that we're going to be in the season where there's almost no Bran.
Right.
I'm pretty sure it's next season.
It is. Yeah. It absolutely is.
And yeah. so we go maybe the entire season without Bran. I think we
He's
did.
He's just
yeah.
up there training.
Yeah. So then when we finally... So it's been a while. And then when we finally come back in season six, Three-Eyed Raven and the main girl of the forest have been recast.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Because this is not... This is like an actual child. The Children of the Forest that we see in all of the later scenes, including the ones where they create the first White Walker.
Yes.
They look like adults. They're just called Children of the Forest.
Right. Right.
And they don't have like an age
yep.
per se, whatever. Anyway, Jojen tells Mira just to go with them, and she cuts his throat and bails crying. Obviously very upsetting. She has to end her brother, but it was also like 100% her fault, so whatever. The little child of the forest has the worst throwing motion.
Yes,
absolutely,
it's awful.
Fucking terrible.
It is
probably
not good.
The main reason she got recast.
Yeah, it's not good.
But she drops a fireball right on Jojen so that he won't come back as a walker or whatever. All the good people bail into a cave underneath the tree, and the skeletons try to follow them, but they explode upon entry. Child of the forest explains, they cannot follow us. The power that moves them is powerless here. Again, you have to think that that's...
Yes, yes.
A White Walker
situation. That's a good point. Yep.
Yeah. Bran asks who the hell she is, and she's like, the first men called us the children, but we were born long before them. Come, he waits for you. Then she takes off down a tunnel. There's roots growing everywhere down here. Shit is wild. It's very cool looking. And then we finally meet him. Three-eyed Raven 1.0. He has a long beard like Merlin, but
yes.
All of his facial hair is kind of like Asian style. Like
yes.
The mustache curls and the beard comes to a point.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little weird. And which is strange because when they recast him,
it's completely wildly different.
He
yes.
just shaved all of it off.
Yeah.
Whatever. There are bones and skulls and shit all over the ground here too. What's that about? Like, at one point, we get the shot of Bran. He's literally, like, crawling over a fucking skull.
Yeah, I don't... Yeah.
It's like, were people studying for so long that they just died? I don't know. I'm just curious as to why there's dead bodies in mm-hmm. there that have rotted to the point of just being skeletons. But I don't know. I don't know enough about this this cave underneath this tree. Anyway. Bran crawls over to him. And says, you're the three-eyed raven. And the three-eyed raven responds, I've been many things. Now I am what you see. And what we see is this old man who appears that he has sat still for so long that a tree grew around him. He's like in
indeed.
A tree.
Indeed, that is what we're seeing.
He's a tree person. Mira is like, my brother brought us to you and now he's dead. And the three-eyed raven tells her he knew what would happen. From the moment he left, he knew and he went anyway. She says, how do you know? And he says, I've been watching you, all of your lives with 1,000 eyes and one. Now you come to me at last, Brandon Stark, though the hour is late. He died so you can find what you've lost. Bran says, you're going to help me walk again? He's like all psyched, like, oh, fuck yeah, let's do this. And Three-Eyed Raven 1.0 says, you will never walk again. And Bran's like, ooh, it's a bummer. But you will fly. And everyone's like, oh shit, Bran's going to be a dragon rider. Or warg into a dragon. And those are pretty much the two standing theories on what he meant there.
Indeed.
Nah. Then on the road to the Vale, Brian and Pod wake up and their horses are gone because Pod hobbled them incorrectly. He ties knots like shit. Apparently Brian taught him how to do a figure eight knot and he blew it.
When you hobble, you gotta hobble right.
Yeah. Maybe
everybody
just,
knows that.
Here's an idea, Brian. You're worried about Pod's hobbling ability? Hobble the fucking horses yourself. Now you don't have any horses. And you're at least 30 miles from the Erie. But and then she makes him carry all the bags.
It's the saddlebags, yeah. Well, you got to.
Yeah.
Somebody's got to carry
them. Somebody's got to do it. It's not going to be the giant woman who would be very unaffected by them. It's going to be the little man who's...
Well, he's a squire, you know?
That's, yeah, it's a bummer.
It's in the job description.
Way of the world. Anyway, they hit the road, and then Brienne hears what sounds like grunting. It's like a little girl, and then it turns out it's Arya, and she's practicing with her sword, Needle. And Arya says something to someone off screen. She says, people coming, you can shit later, there's people coming. Then Brienne and Arya get into this conversation about their swords. The Hound comes out from shitting. Pod immediately recognizes him and says that that's Sandor Clegane, the Hound. And Brienne pieces all of this together in her head. Says, you're Arya Stark. I swore to your mother I would bring her home to you. The Hound thinks Brienne is paid by the Lannisters and therefore a bounty on him because he sees her Valyrian steel sword. He says, that Valyrian steel, I always wanted some Valyrian steel. Arya doesn't want to go with Brienne. I think that the dynamic that I never really had gotten here was that Arya doesn't trust Brienne because Brienne told her that she was sworn to protect her mother and Arya knows that that didn't happen.
Yeah, yeah. This is the whole dynamic here between these three is really confusing and interesting, and I don't completely understand. I think we're on the right track here, but I would also say that the communication is just piss poor.
It's not good.
It's not good because nobody's actually saying anything, and so it's just like, is that a Lannister sword? And she's like, yeah, what of it?
They're all very suspicious of each other.
Instead of explaining, yeah, because they, yeah, right. So it just really ends in this huge...
like, she could have been like, matter of fact, I'm very anti-Lannister.
Right.
Jaime Lannister gave me this because I saved his life. It's this whole fucking thing. But no, I'm not with the Lannisters. I'm actually...
Oh, and it was like melted down from ice, your dad's sword, anything, that whole thing.
Just any number of ways she could have gone about better communicating that she's not a Lannister, that the Hound and her are not enemies.
Right. Hey, Hound, I'm not actually going to kill you. I would just like to protect Arya. Here's my plan.
Right.
She doesn't have one. You know?
No, she doesn't. In fact, she was headed to the Eyrie where the aunt is already dead.
Yeah.
None of this was going to work
out.
It's a
real cluster.
Oh, it's a mess.
But then so tell me this. What's Hound doing now? Is he protecting Arya?
At this point, I think he believes, yes, that that's all he's really got going. He's keeping her safe. Is all she... I mean, Brienne begs Arya to come with her, says
right,
that she'll
right.
take her to safety, and the Hound says, safety? Where the fuck's that? Her aunt in the Eyrie is dead. Her mother's dead. Her father's dead. Her brother's dead. Winterfell is a pile of rubble. There is no safety, you dumb bitch. If you don't know that by now, you're the wrong one to watch over her.
He's right, too. I mean...
Well, it's also like you're kind of just like splitting hairs. Like, okay, so she used the word safety. She probably shouldn't have said safety. Maybe there is no safety. You're being philosophical and weird, Hound. But she wants to watch over her like
yeah.
you are.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Brienne's response to that is, that's what you're doing, watching over her? And the Hound says, aye, that's what I'm doing. Then this fight begins. It is so much more hardcore than I remembered it.
Oh, it is. As soon as they run into each other, I got my classic Game of Thrones tick going on, because this scene also makes me very nervous.
You're what going on?
My tick, like my shakes.
Oh,
my
I thought you said tick. Like, I thought you meant your nipples get hard.
No.
You got shakes.
Yeah. I get those nerves, those Game of Thrones nerves, because it is a brutal fight scene. Brutal.
Maybe the most brutal we ever get. I mean, it doesn't have the ending that, like, say, Jon Snow versus Crazy Carl had.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of brutality, I don't think we ever reached this level. I mean, they did such a good job of making the weight and the size of Brienne and the Hound seem like this colossal... It felt like when you're watching King Kong fight a Tyrannosaurus Rex or some shit. You
right,
know what I mean?
Right. And they did a good job, even though they're open air.
Right.
Like, even though they're out.
Yes.
They did, like, it's very much that kind of close combat thing. Like,
just a
kind
struggle
of, kind
the
of in
time.
The kind of like in the Bourne movies.
Oh, yeah.
Where it's just like... They're just like
hand to hand, baby.
Hand to hand, a foot away from each other, just rocking each
just
other,
pounding faces.
Yes,
yeah. It starts off like sword on sword, steel on steel. The Hound immediately pushes Brienne down a hill, and it gets nasty. Brienne punches him in the face, and these are like hard punches. This is not like some girly punch that you're mad. She fucks him up. He backhands her at one point. They go back to fighting with swords. Finally, Brienne gets him onto the ground. She says, I have no wish to kill you, sir. And he grabs Oathkeeper with both hands by the blade, which is just a psycho move. And he stands up and says, I'm not a knight. He punches her in the face again. She punches him in the balls. He kicks her in the vagina. I totally forgot that.
Yeah, oh yeah.
What the hell?
And I mean, she makes it sound like it hurts.
It doesn't sound or look fun at all. He climbs on top of her. Starts kicking her ass. Then she bites off his ear like Mike Tyson and like spits it out. He pulls a knife and goes at her. She punches him in the face over and over and over and over. Then she goes full berserker mode here and punches him straight off a cliff.
You know the... have you seen one of the early Tarantino films called True Romance?
Yes.
That's also what this reminded me of, is that fight between James Gandolfini and Patricia Arquette in the apartment.
Yeah.
Where it's just like...
Brutal
close quarters, two people
man
just
on woman
beating the shit out
violence,
of each
other. Yeah. What a fucking fight, though. I had forgotten that this one was incredible as it was, and it was long, man. It was...
Yeah.
Anyway, once the Hound goes over the cliff, Brienne stands up and calls to Arya. She can't find her. Podrick can't find her. Podrick was apparently watching to see if Brienne would need help instead of keeping his eye on Arya. He's just a bad squire. They yell for Arya, but Arya is like perfectly camouflaged in a rock. Great spot she chose to hide. Mm-hmm. You could not see her there. She has no intention of going with Brienne. She sneaks off down to the Hound, who is in very, very bad shape. He asks, "You're still here?" He's coughing up blood and shit. He says, "Big bitch saved you." Which is weird. Like, what's his...
That's... Okay, yes. What does he mean?
What's his angle there?
He was fighting Big Bitch to protect her, right?
I think it's that he legit, at this point, does not really know what his purpose is.
Yeah.
Right? And that's what he finds later on. He kind of decides to go all in on being a good guy. But for now, it's still like he's so conflicted. Like, am I a villain? Am I a good guy? Was I protecting her? Was she my hostage?
Yep.
So that's just kind of the words he has. Arya asks the Hound if he's going to die, and he says, "Unless there's a maester hiding behind that rock, I'm done. Killed by a woman. I bet you like that. Go on, go after her. She'll help you. Going it alone, you won't last a day out there." So he's trying to send Arya to with Brienne.
Mm. Yeah.
Then he asks her, Arya, if she remembers where the heart is. Says, "Fuck it, I'm ready. Go on, girl. Another name off your list. You kept promising me. I cut down your butcher's boy, the ginger. He was begging for mercy. Please, sir, please don't kill me. Please, please. Bled all over my horse. Saddle stunk of butcher's boy for weeks. And your sister, your pretty sister, I should have taken her. That night the Blackwater burned. I should have fucked her bloody. At least I'd have one happy memory. Do I have to beg you? Do it. Do it." And Arya just stares at him, like totally unaffected by all this. He's like, "Do it." Arya walks over to him, takes the pouch of gold from his boot. He's like, "Please kill me. Kill me." He's yelling, "Kill me." And Arya just fucking walks
away. Kill him.
Yes. It Dumb and Dumber. It is brutal, man. And then this last time we see him for quite some time, I believe.
Yes.
And we just assume he just bleeds out right there.
Yep. Sure enough.
Then we're back in King's Landing, where Tyrion is sleeping in his cell. He hears someone entering, and he thinks it's somebody who's come to kill him, and he just yells, "Oh, get on with it, you son of a whore." And Jaime responds, "Is that any way to speak about our mother?"
That boy JL coming through.
Yeah, so this is something that kind of hit me here. Inadvertently, by deliberately disobeying and going against Tywin's wishes, Cersei kind of spurred Jaime to take this action.
Yes, I have a similar note, it's a question, really. He finally gets what he wants with Cersei, right? She comes back to him.
Sure.
And somehow, yeah, that like gives him the motivation to help Tyrion.
I think the point here
is the reason he never helped Tyrion.
The reason he didn't free him already. The reason he hasn't shut down this whole fucking stupid Tyrion court, all the shit that went down, is Tywin. And once he sees his sister basically show him, you don't have to do what our dad says. You can do whatever the fuck you want. He has no power over us.
Okay.
Jaime says, "Oh shit, I'm gonna go free my brother."
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I just think that's very strange. Interesting. Yeah. No, I've never thought of that perspective.
Yeah, it certainly is.
Jaime says Varys is helping them and that there's a ship waiting to take Tyrion to the Free Cities. Jaime takes him over to this passageway. He says there's a locked door at the top of the stairs. Knock on it twice, then knock twice again. Varys will open it. Tyrion says, "I suppose this is goodbye then." They hug it out. Jaime kisses his cheek, says, "Farewell, little brother." And Tyrion says, "Jaime, thank you for my life." Then he's on his way. But Tyrion doesn't turn and leave. He wants to, just before he can go up these stairs to Varys, it's not that he's like realizing he has unfinished business. I think he just decides, like, I have to fucking end this. I have to go, like, clean break with me and my father in one way or another. And I don't really know if he knew what that meant or what it was going to be, what the outcome was going to be, but he needed to have one last face off with his dad. Right? Is that kind of what you took from it?
Yeah.
Like, what turns him around?
I don't know.
Because there's nothing else you can explain it with, right? It's just, it seems like such a risky move.
He goes straight to his dad's bedroom.
Right.
So he's not really looking for Shay because he wouldn't not really have any reason.
This is all about his dad, not about Shay at all, until it is, but.
Right. So, because he wouldn't have any reason to suspect that necessarily.
Right.
So he's going there to see to, yeah, I think you're right. To because he has to, he wants some closure
with his dad.
With his dad.
Closure is the word I was looking for.
Yeah. That's
absolutely what, I think that's the only real explanation. Closure with Tywin. And now I don't think he knew what that meant or what maybe even the options were. I think he was willing to have himself die.
Sacrifice to his freedom.
For that closure.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like basically, I think he thought, what the fuck am I going to do in the Free Cities?
Mm.
This, because remember, given the option to leave or thinking about leaving before, he was like, no, like, this is my place. I love playing this game. I'm very good at it. It's the only thing I'm good at.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to be in King's Landing, and I think he kind of has another, you know, that's his thought process here still, and that's why he ends up turning back. He goes through this trap door into Tywin's chambers. In he walks. He's not even being that quiet, which is another reason, like, I don't think his initial intention was to attack Tywin. He's just walking normally. He's not like sneaking. You know what I mean?
Right.
He goes into the bedroom, and that's where he sees a woman, a naked woman that is wrapped in his father's sheets right there in his father's bed, right there on Tywin's Lisa mattress. As we know.
Just adding insult to injury. She really does, doesn't she?
She finally got the opportunity to sleep on a Lisa mattress, and she took it. Because Shay knew a quality night's sleep can help you recover from distractions quickly, prevent burnout, and you make better decisions. Your memory overall is better. You make fewer mistakes. And the great thing is that Lisa, in order to design a better mattress, leveraged 30 plus years of experience and hundreds of hours of testing to develop the perfect mattress for all body shapes and sleeping styles, whether you're shaped like Varys or Tywin or Tyrion or Shay here. It's all good. Greatest bed ever made. And through their 110 program, they donate one mattress for every 10 they sell. They have donated over 26,000 mattresses and counting so far. Lisa strives to leave the world a better place than they found it. And that doesn't stop with the mattress donations. They also, with the Arbor Day Foundation, plant one tree for every mattress they sell and have committed to planting 1 million trees by 2025. So by going to lisa.com/dragon, LEESA.com/dragon, you get $160 off your Lisa mattress this summer. Do not miss out on these summer savings. Barrett and I both have Lisa mattresses. We love them. Barrett, do you love your bed?
I do. I got a story time.
Tell us a story, my friend.
Okay, so this past week, I was at a beach house in Holden Beach, North Carolina. And I was sleeping on a bed where the mattress had to have been 30 years old. It was nothing but just, you could feel every single spring in that mattress.
Why is it that these always are in vacation houses, these 30-year-old mattresses?
Because they know that they don't have to replace them.
Yeah.
But this is a beach house that I might have to go back to for the foreseeable future. And you know what? I'm very strongly considering just ordering my own Lisa mattress down to this beach house because they're so comfortable and I need this bed so badly. My back's all tweaked up from not sleeping on my Lisa for 6 days.
That, I guess that's the one downside of having mattress. the best mattress that money can buy, the Lisa mattress, is that when you go sleep on somebody's shitty 30-year-old vacation home mattress,
yeah,
your back gets fucked up.
But oh my God, how nice was it to return finally last night to my Sapira by Lisa mattress?
That's a nut moment right there.
Yes.
Great mattresses, unbelievable beds, great pillows, sheets, lisa.com/dragon.
Dragon.
Get yourself some. So as Tyrion gets closer, he starts to recognize the girl in this bed. She starts to stir a little bit. She says, Tywin, my lion. And she rolls her head over, and it's Shay. Look, this was going to be brutal no matter what, but her saying my lion, it's really the line that makes you question if everything with Shay was bullshit all along, right? It has to.
Yes, I think it makes you question that. If you watch the inside the episode, what they kind of point to is when Tyrion, you know, kind of makes his last ditch effort,
my lion,
to save her, and basically goes back and calls her a whore. You know, he screams it at her. He's like,
yes,
you're a whore. How could I
be
with
you? He's trying to get her to leave.
And he's trying to get her to leave. He's trying to like make the breakup like very clear and cut and final.
He's trying to break her heart.
Right. And get her to leave. What it kind of does to her is like almost like pushes her back to accepting that as her
fate, as her role in life
and her fate to be that. But yes, it does. The fact that she uses that same
My Lion.
Yeah.
What she called a Tyrion time and time again.
It's super messed up. Because
think about that, dude. Like, all right, there's levels to this shit. And when you cheat on somebody, it's one thing. But if I find out you cheat on me and you called this other fucking dude my nickname, bitch, it is on. And that's not to be sexist. It goes both ways. Like, I'm just saying, that is next level fucking betrayal. And you can feel it. And this is like, for me, one of the hardest scenes to watch in the show. It's so brutal. Like, we've watched this love affair unfold between Tyrion and Shay, and it's been very complicated and confusing, and we've never really known, like, how many seasons now? You and me been asking. And now this is the
Shay
moment.
Shay Watch. Yeah. At least, yeah, two whole seasons, I think. And maybe
it's,
three.
It's just crazy to see it come down to this, where he doesn't even get a word in. She says, my lion, and then she pounces to go for that knife, and he climbs on top of her, and the fight is on. Like, he grabs her by that gold necklace. She punches him off the bed, and then he just holds on to the giant gold necklace, and he pulls, like, and pulls and pulls and pulls with all of his might until she is dead and gone. He didn't even get a fucking word in.
Nope.
And we get that incredible shot of him holding the gold necklace still, like, clutching it in his hands, and Shay's dead face is upside down next to him, like, hanging off the bed, and he just says, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. And it's almost like, it's not even an apology. I mean, obviously it's an apology for killing her, but it's like an apology for letting her down.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't get her out of the situation. He didn't succeed in protecting this woman that he loved. And he's ruined by that, obviously. And that's when he looks to the wall and he sees the golden crossbow. He takes it. I don't know how he got it off the wall. Maybe there's a little ladder or steps a little somewhere. But he walks down the hall with the crossbow and the reloader. You always forget the guy gotta have that fucking reloader.
Mm-hmm.
That thing sucks. Yeah. Crossbows suck. Just get a gun, guy. They don't exist yet. Anyway, he walks down the hall. He opens the door to the chamber pot, and he finds his father, Tywin. But the first thing, and I hate to break away from the seriousness of the scene to talk about something a little silly, but you got to imagine this is the nicest bathroom in the whole fucking world, right? This is the richest man in Westeros.
Right.
Still such a basic plumbing situation. It's a wooden door, and then you sit on a wooden bench and you poop into a hole.
That's correct.
That's it, man. Yeah. It's a porta potty. That's what that is. It's just kind of a bummer.
I think there is some type of rudimentary sewer system that takes, you know, because they talk about, does right down in Fleabottom on Gen Alley, that's just right where the poop comes out, I
all
think.
The poop flows. But remember, Tyrion at one point was in charge of the sewer system either at King's Landing or at
Casterly Rock.
Yeah. Anyway, he walks in there. His dad's taking a dump in the middle of the night for some reason. I guess old guys, you know, it is what it is. He says, Tyrion, put down the crossbow. Who released you? Ah, your brother, I expect. He always had a soft spot for you. We'll go and talk in my chambers.
He's super, like, calm and collected.
Yeah.
You know, he's really trying to... He's
trying to take control of the situation.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And we get this close-up of the golden crossbow, which has got this the Lannister lion prominently on the front in gold molding. It's very fucking cool. And Tyrion's still not saying a word. Tywin continues, this is how you want to speak to me, hmm? Shaming your father has always given you pleasure. And then finally, Tyrion breaks his silence. He says, all my life, you've wanted me dead. Tywin says, yes, which doesn't seem like the move here, to be honest, but he does. Tyrion says, Tywin says, but you refuse to die. I respect that, even admire it. You fight for what's yours. I'd never let them execute you. Is that what you fear? I'd never let Illyn Payne take your head. You're a Lannister. You're my son. And this is where it gets, like, pretty transparent, right? Mm-hmm. He realizes his life's in peril. He's just straight up fucking lying. And Tyrion knows that. He doesn't even care. The words coming out of Tywin's mouth aren't even really ringing in Tyrion's mind. He's just thinking about what he just had to do, which is murder the woman he loves. And he says, I loved her. Like, kind of almost under his breath. And Tywin says, who? He legit doesn't know who he's talking about. Tyrion says, Shay. And Tywin's like, oh, Tyrion, put down that crossbow. Tyrion says, I murdered her with my own hands. Tywin says, it doesn't matter. Tyrion says, it doesn't matter. Tywin says she was a whore. And Tyrion says, say that word again. It's like, say, what is the Pulp Fiction line? He keeps asking a question over and over, and Samuel L. Jackson say, "Oh, what?" He's like, "Say what one more time, motherfucker." This was like that. It's like, this conversation just keeps going on and on, and you knew it was coming. You knew there was going to be a moment where Tywin snaps off and accidentally says it again, but he says, like, as the conversation unfolds, Tywin says, "Enough. We'll go back to my chambers and speak with some dignity." And Tyrion replies, "I can't go back there. She's in there." And Tywin says, "What? You afraid of a dead whore?" Come on, man. Anyway, crossbow thud straight to the stomach. It's like, you know, over where the heart would be, except further down. Then Tyrion goes to reload, and Tywin says, "You shot me. You shot me right in the arm." Nah, that's Austin Powers. He says, "You shot me. You're no son of mine." Didn't take much for him to break away from the bullshit narrative he was trying to use to preserve his life. Tyrion says, "I am your son. I have always been your son." And then he shoots him again. And that's the scene. That's how Tywin gets murdered on the
Who throws his shoe? Honestly.
Hello? Can anyone hear me? I've been very badly burnt, but I'm still alive. That's Will Ferrell. It took me like 15 years to realize that guy's Will Ferrell.
Yeah,
for real. Anyway, next thing we see is Tyrion at the door, Varys opening it, and Varys immediately realizes, like, based on the timing, I'm assuming, based on how long he stood there waiting, he's like, "What have you done?" He knows he's gone and done something. Yeah. So Varys takes Tyrion and he puts him in a box with holes on it, in it. It looks just like the one he brought that wizard over in who cut him.
Mm-hmm.
I think it might be the same box. I'm not kidding.
Could be.
I have
Could
this
be.
Theory that this is the exact same box. He says, "Trust me, my friend, I've brought you this far." And that box gets loaded onto a ship. We see this whole scene. There's bells tolling in the distance. Varys turns to walk back towards King's Landing after Tyrion gets loaded up in his box. And then when the bells are tolling to signify that the Hand of the King is dead, I assume, he realizes, like, oh, man, I'm done here. He can't go back. There's no way for him to go. There's no way for him to play this thing out in King's Landing any further. It's just... for Varys and Tyrion, their time in King's Landing is over. So he goes up onto the ship. He sits right next to Tyrion's box. Varys and Tyrion out.
Yeah, yeah. Was Varys planning on not leaving?
Yes. Varys was initially turning around to... it was just getting Tyrion out for Tyrion.
Oh.
And he was turning around to go continue his whole playing the game thing. But when the bells toll and he realizes, I think he thinks about, like, how is there going to be any way for me to not get killed here at this point?
Right, right.
You know what I mean?
Okay. That makes sense. I'm surprised that the bells were tolling so quickly. How do you think somebody, like, heard and, like, went and checked? Or, like, how did somebody find him so quickly?
I think you figure, okay, between loading Tyrion up into the box and having that box transported down to the docks... let's say an hour passes,
okay.
Right?
All
right. So they found Tywin. The correct people have been informed. Mm-hmm. The bells are tolling. I get it.
Yeah.
It makes sense in a time frame for me.
Okay.
But anyway, so they're leaving King's Landing. Tyrion, Varys, out. Arya, we cut to her. She's on horseback, and she sees a bunch of ships at a dock in the distance, so she rides over. She finds a captain, tells him she wants to go north of the wall. She's trying to get to her brother Jon at Castle Black. She says she can work scrubbing the floors and shit. The dude's like, "No, listen, you don't want to go north. And besides, we're going to Braavos." And she's like, "Well, shit, I have this coin." He's like, "No amount of gold is going to make any difference." And she said, or no silver is going to make any difference. And she says, "It's iron, actually." And gives him the Braavosi coin that Jaqen H'ghar had given her. So many names. I've come a long way since what? Season 6 when we first started doing this thing. She says, "Valar Morghulis."
He says, "Valar Dohaeris."
Oh my god. And apparently, we find out that what this coin scores you is a cabin. He's like, "Of course you get a cabin."
Well, it scores you the ride to Braavos.
I mean, it scores you any favor with a Braavosi,
I guess. But it also gets you... Yeah, it gets you. It gets you everything. It gets
you, get a, you,
you
get a full
you get
blown
a,
bed.
You get a full blown cabin.
Now maybe it doesn't have at least a mattress, but it's a fucking cabin.
Right.
It's better
right.
than sleeping on the poop right. deck.
You gotta have two to get the Lisa.
You
gotta
don't
have two of those.
Yeah, you gotta get. have two. Ah. Anyway, so off Arya goes to Braavos. She's like looking back on the ship. She's on the ship looking back at Westeros that she's leaving. And then she very symbolically runs to the front of the ship and is looking out at the future where she's going. Boom. The season ends. And what a fucking season it was. I want to play a hotline call real quick. One
really
more
was.
Call.
Really was a season.
Before we get into the season as a whole. Here it is.
What's up, guys? This is Jack from Richmond. Just wanted to say that we've now gone through four seasons and I've yet to hear a single 1 to 10 rating of the episode at the end of the podcast. I really miss how harsh Barrett used to be on those. So as an active member of the Clan Fam, I vote to bring them back. I might even have to invoke some eye on this one. Also, side note, my personal unpopular opinion, but this episode is the best of the entire series. It moved the plotline forward in the best way. One of the biggest cliffhangers. Very emotional with Dany and the dragons and Jon burning Ygritte. And in my opinion, top three scenes of Game of Thrones with the Hound and Brienne's fight. Try to change my mind on this one, guys, but peace out.
At least me?
Wait, what did I used to do? What did I used to do?
Rate the episodes and like, whenever we were in season 6 and 7.
Yeah.
You would just be harsh on them. But here's the thing. I don't think you can be harsh on this season, man.
This
I really
is a
don't.
Fantastic season.
This top to bottom, to me, with where we're at, and granted, we still have to watch 5, 6, and 7, right? That's but we're 4 deep. Best season. There's not a comparison. Maybe season 1 you could try to say, but no.
Yeah.
Season 4 was so unbelievably good.
It was very, very good.
And I won't, like, dude, the argument that Brienne and the Hound, top 5, top 3 scene, whatever he said, I don't think you can even argue against that. Like, it was so good, dude.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I'd kind of have to, like, break it out into the type of scene. You know, it's certainly one of the best fight scenes. No questions asked there.
That's fair. I don't think you could say top 3 scene ever because it's, like, I think, to your point, there's categories. Fight scene probably gets tough there. Right, there's some unbelievable fight scenes that we see in this show. It just gets tough, but
yeah, I mean, number one scene, the opening of Winds of Winter, right? Like easy, kind of.
What are we talking about here?
The piano
God,
music
yes.
and Cersei.
I would
up the
argue
set.
That is. Does that even count as a scene?
And then
it's like 8 minutes.
And then fighting for somewhere for number two is. I mean, you got a lot of stuff. You got like I don't know. There's a lot of powerful stuff. So.
Yeah, well, okay.
So, you know, it's an awesome, awesome scene. Definitely one of the top fight moments of the whole series. And I'm with you that this episode is up there as well. It's great.
The season, though, man.
The season as a whole is definitely...
Shocked by how much went on in this season. But from the death of Joffrey to the Red Wedding to Tyrion's trial to Shae to Tywin to everything in between, all the...
Well, Red Wedding is season 3.
Oh, yeah, sorry. But all the bullshit that went on... I mean, cause getting Joffrey's death early on, I forgot how early it was.
Yeah.
And then the season just kind of keeps... the other thing, big thing being the Mountain and the Viper.
Yeah.
That
Tywin,
whole fight.
Baelish gets Sansa out of King's Landing.
Aunt Lysa gets murdered.
Aunt Lysa flies through the moon door.
A lot of important people get got.
The Wildlings attack the Wall.
It's a... fucking wild season.
It is, yeah.
Ygritte died,
yeah. I mean, it's a huge season.
It's almost, for me, it's like, it might be the one that set the bar too high. And then when you have seasons like 7, it's like, you just can't fit that much in like they did
here. It does set the bar really, really high because we get big deaths. We get amazing set pieces. Like episode 9 is called Watchers on the Wall.
The Watchers on the Wall, yeah.
Yeah. We get big set pieces and, like, you know, great battles like that.
Yeah.
We get, but then we still are getting, like, those moments of just, you know, Cersei and Tywin, like, arguing in the Hands room. And
yeah, these
I
great
mean,
little conversations.
Yeah, so it just really, it comes together here. We get the big moments, the big deaths, the big fights, but we still get all the little... You know, the goings-ons, the happenings, the scheming, the conversations, the two people talking in a room. So
right.
it's pretty,
it was, I mean, I was...
Pretty epic season.
I'm sad this shit's over. and that we're going into season five, but we are. So we'll be back next Monday to talk about the first season or the first episode of season five, titled "The Wars to Come," written by Benioff and Weiss and directed by Michael Slovis. Michael Slovis,
Slovdog millionaire.
The Slovis. I think this is his first one. If I'm not sure. Follow the podcast on Instagram at Oysters, Clams, and Cockles, and on Twitter at Clams and Cockles. We're also on Facebook somewhere. Through all those social medias, we put out announcements about new podcasts. We put out great content related to the most recent episodes we talked about, as well as just funny overall Game of Thrones content that we think is worth sharing.
Would you say that the Clams and Cockles Instagram account is the spiciest meme lord out there as it pertains to Game of Thrones?
I would argue that.
Are you a spicy meme lord?
I would argue. I wouldn't call myself that. I would argue that the account as a whole is the spiciest Game of Thrones account, though, that exists on Twitter.
Yeah. On Instagram. Spicy memes all day long.
Yeah, spicy. You just derailed me. Okay, yeah. Anyways, you can follow me, Ross Bolin, on social media, on Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat, at WR Bolin. Barrett, where can everybody in the Clam Fam follow you?
Oh, get at me on the social mediums, Instagram and Twitter, at Barrett Dudley. You can expect to find all sorts of things there, from style and clothing to me endorsing my favorite breakfast foods, Thomas English Muffins. Thomas English Muffins, get at me. Let's sponsor the podcast. You can also find me salting brands that I hate, like Smile Direct Club. Do not try to get your teeth fixed there. They will screw you over. You can at me if you want more information, but they're a dog shit company, and I gotta put them in the frying pan right now. So don't do it.
I can't believe you just spent your social media plug, both putting up Thomas English Muffins and shitting on Smile Direct Club, the two most obscure things I've ever heard someone love and hate on in the same sentence. Holy shit!
Yeah.
At Barrett Dudley. Yeah. Oh, God. Hey, listen, for being a part of the Clam Fam, you can also go to rowdygentleman.com and invoke Sumai at checkout. You'll get 10% off your entire order. Rowdy Gentleman is our in-house clothing brand. We design, develop, put together all the products that are on the site. Barrett plays a huge part in that. That's his, I don't know if you call it your day job.
This is technically
your day job, too.
True. But
it's the main focus of your work is Rowdy Gentleman and putting together all the clothing. We've got great Hawaiian shirts, t-shirts, swim trunks, hats, unbelievably good stuff. And right now, we're having something called Freedom Week, which is 3 days of freebies to gear up for the 4th of July. So if you hop on there, it's Monday, June 18th. If you get on there this week, there's like a gift you get with each order of X amount of dollars. Today's a 97 first team all-conference champions hat if you spend $60 or more.
If you're a listener of this podcast and you go to rowdygentleman.com or you get the emails and you're like, what is this? Why is it called that? Okay, I named it this, and maybe it's not the greatest name ever, but it's supposed to look, it's the look of like those 90s like starter caps that you'd see for NFL teams that had like the big waves across them and the big shark teeth. So that is what the name references, is it's just like those late 90s like kind of like crazy starter cap looks.
The 97 first team all conference champions hat.
Yeah. So I just kind of took all the things and
jammed
them up into one name. But it's pretty cool. It's a good 4th of July hat. You know,
we've got a ton grilling, of other great it's stuff.
It's a great,
for the 4th.
Great hat for grilling dogs.
Mm.
Maybe smoking a brisket, riding on a, I don't know, a lake boat, pontoon maybe. Maybe you're getting into jet ski or some wake surfing. I don't know. Just get you it.
It's a great hat to stick a bottle rocket in your ass. It is. Can't you see a guy wearing that hat with a bottle rocket in his ass?
Yeah, if you're that dude, you need that hat.
Sumai. Invoke it at checkout, Sumai, on rowdygentleman.com to get 10% off your whole order. Our hotline number is 866-43-CLAMS. We'd very much appreciate it if you have enjoyed the show, if you've enjoyed season 4 of the Night's Rewatch and the 3 we did before it. To show your support, please go on iTunes and don't just subscribe, but also give us a 5-star rating and write a quick review. It goes a long way to help the continued growth of the show. We love you all. Thank you, Clam Fam, for the support. We will start season 5 next week. Whoop. Thank you very much.
Whoop, 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 whoop.